Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce.
Today, I'm speaking with Will Nitza, founder and CEO of IQBar, the plant-based protein company for your brain and body. Will started IQBar online in 2017 with a Kickstarter after college and quickly started racking up retail doors with the great-tasting, low-sugar, low-carb, plant-based protein bar. Now the company is about 50% e-com and 50% retail, selling in 8,000 doors across the U.S. Welcome, Will. You're welcome. I think a lot of listeners are probably familiar with you and your shower thoughts. I think a lot of them know IQBar for sure, but more and more people in my LinkedIn network, at least, are starting to recognize you from your LinkedIn postings. And I think just a little credit to you. I like the fact that you're, you know, I understand, I guess I have a sort of a, the prolific posters where there isn't much thought, where it's just like a kind of a quote or something that like is somewhat self-explanatory, I find to be sort of like algorithm hunting, but you post thoughtful things and you actually have so many thoughts in one post and I like it. I just want to say I like it. Yeah, you're welcome. And you said something in one of those where you talked about thinking in public, not building in public. And I think you summed up for me the difference between the sort of LFG, you know, we're crushing, look at us, look at this, look at me. That's what building in public has become, this almost sort of false humility, if there's any humility in it at all. But what you're doing is more, you know, sort of getting us thinking about things. Some of them are kind of funny, but for the most part, I think it's useful and I think it's educational, I guess. And that's maybe why I like it. And so I guess I'm wondering, my first question to, before we get into anything IQBar, is about, was that an intentional content plan or did you just start thinking publicly? And now that you do it, do you feel pressure to keep it going, pressure to come up with clever stuff? Do you ever get nervous that you've said something over a line of some sort? Like, where are you, I guess, with that?
Yeah. So basically, I'll tell you exactly why I decided to start doing it. Basically, we were, my wife and I, who she works in the company too, she's our head of marketing. And one of her friends who we were paying to help us with a few PR related things, we were just sitting there after work one day shooting the shit about what, like in this, as a CPG company, you don't do things that are all that PR worthy all that often, right? Like what does Forbes cover? It covers fundraisers and that's it, pretty much. Or acquisitions, uh-huh. Yeah.
Right.
And so, like, launching a flavor, doing anything that is maybe meaningful to you is not actually meaningful to publications. So mm-hmm. that's kind of brands like mine and yours probably bang our heads against the wall trying to figure out how are people going to cover us? And the answer is they won't. And even if they did, it's not all that useful or relevant. It always right. drives less actual results than you want it to. Mm-hmm. And so then the question becomes, well, okay, what if you then, you know, take control and become your own publication, quote unquote? How would you mm-hmm. do that? Where would you do that? And what angle would you take when doing that? And mm-hmm. and then sort of the conversation went to a place of, okay, what are the content saturated channels and what are the content deficient channels? Meaning what channels have more content than they do have demand for than they have demand mm-hmm. for content and vice versa. And so like Instagram has more content than it has demand for content, but something like LinkedIn and TikTok at the time yep. were the inverse of that. They had it was mostly lurkers, quote unquote, or mm-hmm. consumers of information, and they under-indexed on creators of information,
yep.
which, of course, is valuable to the creators because the platform will force out your content to more people. Mm-hmm. And I just think it was a good arbitrage opportunity. So if you look at LinkedIn, it's actually massive. Like, everyone has one. It has this legacy sort of people have this legacy perception of, oh, it's, you know, you upload your resume or whatever, right, and that's right, it. Right. And it doesn't have a reputation for being a place where you have a feed of useful content. And mm-hmm. so I was like, I don't want to do the TikTok thing all that much because I don't want to take videos right. of myself dancing or whatever. Mm-hmm. I like writing and the written word, and I like medium form too. So Twitter mm-hmm. wasn't a great fit because I don't, pithy quick hits are not as exciting to me as like medium form, decently thought out thoughts. And so I was like, all right, it's content deficient. It aligns with the way I like to produce thoughts. Why don't I just try it? Like, why don't I just write a post every single day? Mm-hmm. For a while and just like see if it works. And I also had this huge backlog of, I think this is probably thoughts. Relatable to you and any entrepreneur. Yeah. I just have all these, you know, when you go throughout a day, because there is no playbook for something like starting and running a CPG brand, you have all these thoughts where you're like, oh, that's how that works. Cause no one ever actually told you. And mm-hmm. whenever that happens, I actually mark it down. I'm like, the insight light bulb goes off. I write it down in a Google Doc. And so I just have this chicken scratch Google Doc of like hundreds and hundreds of random like insights I've developed.
Yep.
And so it's not all that hard to create content because it's like, oh, I'll just pluck one of those and flesh it out. So yeah, that was the why. But of course you run out at some point and you're like, oh crap, how do I create that next thought?
There's some, I don't remember the exact quote, but it's like, when it's not when the means become the end, but it's kind of like when the something becomes the something, like when we mistake the goal for the tactic, you know, I don't remember the exact quote, but sometimes I feel like that's what happens with something like a LinkedIn. So similar to you, I mean, I am, I think twice your age, but I don't have any personal social media and I've never had a Facebook, never been on Twitter. And Instagram, you know, the brand has, I don't. I feel very comfortable on LinkedIn because I feel like it is me thinking out loud. And it's, I can speak to people in a different way. And I can, and I feel like my part of this community is somewhat to be a helpful, supportive friend to a lot of people in it. What starts to happen though, if I start reading these things on, here's how you should post and it should be every day. And this is how you, then it starts to feel like I'm like forcing myself to come up with something clever to say. And candidly, I don't think anyone has something clever to say every day. I really don't. And so, you know, I guess that's where I was sort of wondering, like, if you start to feel, cause you don't strike me as a guy who's going to put something out that isn't, that feels a little half-assed to yourself.
No. And It's a much more like clean, regimented platform because everyone has their reputation tied to it. And so but even within that, there's a lot of riffraff content. And I think a lot of it is due to what you're saying. It's that forcing mechanism. I have to put something out, so I'm going to force it and it's not going to be good. And you're right. I like could never do that because,
right.
And it's a little bit challenging if you put out good stuff or what at least you think is good stuff, then it has to keep being good.
Of course, that's the pressure. Yeah.
You corner yourself a little bit. So it's good and bad. I actually do oddly that maybe this is a perverse trait of mine or whatever, but I actually do like forcing myself into things. Like because if left to my own devices, I would do less things. It's kind of like anything, right. Like anything
it
hard physically.
A discipline for you.
Yeah, like I don't want to work out, but I actually like having a forcing mechanism of working out. And it's kind of similar with writing. But yeah, it is tough. And so you have to come up with different things. I remember I listened to an interview with Mr. Beast, and it's like, how do you keep putting out like hit after hit after hit? And he's like, I've been through all these. You have to basically create ways to generate inspiration, like exogenously, right? So like go consume content that will give you ideas, or go have experiences that'll give you ideas, or go to talk to people that will give you ideas. And you need to create an architecture such that the output will be ideas. Otherwise, you're never going to have a constant stream of ideas.
Right. No, I think about the podcast, right? I mean, as we talked about, we're on episode 199. So I have 200 episodes starting in March of 2018, interviewing experts, founders, service providers, right? Like there are some people listening now who've listened to every single one, which is crazy to me. But I take notes on every single show. And I don't write out show notes. I don't make, you know, a post about every show. Like it's almost like I could write a book with what I've learned from the 200 people that I've interviewed. But I think it's funny because you're saying, I was like, oh, I should train myself to like the discipline of this. but I just find it's like overwhelming for me to even think about, you know?
Like there's multiple ways to do it. And again, I'm not saying you should do this. I'm just saying if you're operating under the assumption that you want to create like whatever the cadence is, let's say daily, like many people are really, really good at curating. And so they're not actually generating their own insight. They might, they might interview people and they say, here's the most interesting thing that person said. And it's novel, but it wasn't their thought. And that's still incredibly valuable. So it doesn't have to be
a thought.
Original thought after original thought.
Yeah. No, I was wondering if I could use AI and just put in all of every document from the last 200 shows with all of my notes. And if I could just ask it to summarize it into 300 insights. One other question I have before we get into actually like your product and sales that's LinkedIn related is, personal brand versus product brand. And this is something that, you know, I understand these days it's really hard for those of us who are not celebrities to compete. You know, our CAC is just essentially too high compared to theirs. So a lot of it is like, if you don't have a celebrity, it's kind of, you got to be, like you said, right? If you're not going to get a lot of press, be the publication. And I see a lot of founders doing it, and I think it has value. It certainly has value. I've found that buyers are more likely to reach out to me. You know, it builds goodwill in the community for sure. I don't know. I have ambivalence around connecting the brand too much to me personally, you know, just because I want it to be this thing that doesn't, that I don't need to be I want it to live without me quite comfortably, if that makes sense. And so I guess one of my questions for you is, like, do you see your building, your personal brand? Obviously, it's an asset to building the product brand, but where do you see the line a little bit, and how do you kind of like see yourself sort of releasing or separating yourself from it? Are you seeing that those are two completely compartmentalized things?
I think they can be and they cannot be. And like either setup could could work. Ideally, like if you were just to look at it objectively, ideally they would be quite aligned. Like for me, for instance, like we try to create brain and body focused stuff. And so like me trying to be witty or insightful or, you know, there's like the obvious like connecting of the dots there.
Yep.
And, you know, like the dude wipes guy, Sean, is like silly and tells bathroom jokes
duty.
And like that works. Like, you know, it's like that's aligned. Right. So it's like I do think there's value in being aligned. I don't actually think you have to be, but I do think there's value. This one falls under the bucket of stuff that I would say like it's risky, but who cares? Like there's a lot of things I would say risky. But who cares? So like connecting your personal brand to your regular brand, it might be risky in the sense that, for example, if someone wanted to acquire you, they might say, well, will this brand survive without that person? I don't know the answer. Like maybe, maybe not. So it's risky in that sense, but who cares? Like it,
right.
Like what, how else are you going to
do it? Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You're not going to not do it. Because you doing it helps you acquire more customers more cheaply. And so you'd be dumb to not do it. So just do it. And like, it, like a lot of the fears we have, just like anything in life, you fabricate and maybe that fabrication then ultimately aligns with reality. Maybe it doesn't, but it's a similar concept to like, which I think we might talk about later around like platform versus single form factor. Like, for us, is it a risk to have play in multiple categories? Yeah, but who cares? Like, if you're going to build, if you think you can build a bigger business faster doing that,
do it.
Yep. If you want to do it. So that's kind of how I think about it.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think sometimes I over justify not doing things because they're not comfortable. So I come up with a very logical explanation to sort of satisfy my own, you know, not wanting to do something a little bit. So I'm hearing you loud and clear on that.
A lot of it's like the cringe factor too, right? Like,
yeah, totally. Yeah.
You know, it is cringy to do certain things. I had one post about it because I think about this a lot actually, where there's all these things that I think are annoying or cringeworthy, but they objectively work. And again, just purely objectively, what works is what matters. If you're just thinking about like, not is this cool or do I respect this or whatever, if you're just thinking about what is effective, like in a business context, that's kind of all that matters. So I've tried to get over what like my own ego or what I think is cool or respectable and just look at what objectively worked, right? So that LFG type stuff, which I have a similar reaction to you. Does it work though? Seemingly at least somewhat. Will I do it because of that? No, I'll look for another way to get a commensurate level of effectiveness. But if I couldn't, would I ever rule that like kind of angle out? No, I don't rule any angle out. It's because at the end of the day, what's effective is what matters.
Well, especially I read this incredible post months ago on like the Kardashians, right? And it was when one of them got in trouble for something and, you know, they're Teflon, right? And the post was so cogent because she was like, listen, their brand is and never has changed from, you know, publicity at all costs, money, and like showiness. So you've never heard any one of them apologize for any of the gaffes. You've never heard any one of them sort of like mea culpa anything, right? Because to them, it's super aligned with the brand when, you know, people hate them essentially, because that is part of the brand. So it goes back to that alignment, I guess, to your point. If part of your brand is this like rocket ship, yay, you know, crush it, kill it thing, then it's aligned, whether it's cringy or not. I think when you get the cringe is when something feels forced or pushed, or something feels totally unself-aware. And that's where I think a lot of us are like,
The crush it thing, though, is actually think is not objectively the best way to do it. Because what happens when you stop crushing it? Or what happens when you hit a rough patch? It's not a diversified strategy, right? Whereas just saying interesting stuff is diversified. You're not dependent on, quote unquote, crushing it or getting new doors or whatever. So I'd rather have, it's like a stock portfolio, like if all your money is in Tesla, like, and then,
Well, it goes back to sustainability, right? It's like monoculture. You got to have a lot of diverse crops to have a really good ecosystem. And I think, you know, a lot of people sort of start to feel like, you know, it feels like a little protesting too much in some ways. All right. I want to talk about the bars for a minute before we take a break. And I want to go to something I heard you say or read you say. I don't know which one, but, you know, launching a bar in, you know, what, 2017 was it?
Yeah, we did a Kickstarter December 17 through Jan 18 was our first sales.
Yeah. So, you know, very big category, lots of competition. But I, you know, I'm sort of in this opposite camp where I'm creating a new category that, you know, has its challenges for sure. But you were very clear. You knew it was a very big competitive market. You knew there was a higher percentage of both success and failure. And you just made your job to sort of outcompete the incumbents. And from my understanding, the way you took that is that you, A, rode a wave of keto and like functionality hard. People buy bars for particular functions. And you started online, which is, you know, there was a lot of space for you to win there. And you kind of skipped that traditional playbook of like, you start in your local health food store, then you go to the Whole Foods region, then you go to the, you know, like, it seems like you did three things pretty differently from the folks before you. And I'm just wondering, A, if that's somewhat of a good synopsis, but B, you know, how much thought went into it? And when you're going into a very big, very competitive category, what are the things that you're trying to keep in mind as you're doing that?
Totally. Yeah. And then there's like the whole financing piece, which I actually think we did somewhat counterintuitively as well. But I mean, I think if you want to make an Airbnb or whatever, where it's you're creating this entirely new thing and it's going to be this, probably not going to work, but if it works, it's some giant outsized result because you're the only one there, or you're the first one there or whatever. Like that just, there's no question that is the way to get the biggest absolute results. Mm-hmm. I've never been interested in that because I've never wanted to be caught manufacturing demand. I've always wanted to service demand because I think I can beat everyone else because I think I can just outperform them. I think I can out-operate them. And so I just rather go head-to-head and compete with people for that large bolus of demand, wherever it is.
Right. Yep.
But that's just like my like demeanor or predilections or whatever. And so everyone always says, you know, bars are so competitive. But that's, to me, has always been like, drinks are competitive. Well, yeah, but yeah. Sometimes you want lemonade and sometimes you want a Coke Zero. Those are radically different. It's not actually useful to say something's competitive at that level. You have to delve down at least one or two more tiers. So, okay, if bars are really competitive, cool. I don't care. What about like low sugar bars? Okay, they're less competitive. Okay, what about low sugar, high plant protein bars? Well, actually, that's not all that competitive. You know, let's say there's five people, and the lack of the competitiveness under indexes relative to the market size or the demand from the market. So, okay, so now it's not competitive. So the whole this is competitive is completely moot once you go one or two tiers down. Not to say that that's like, I'm oversimplifying it, obviously. And it's not exactly like, there still are substitutes within even that subcategory where someone might just have a Clif Bar instead of ours and whatnot. But generally speaking, that's how I think about it. And so, yeah, so I like playing in big competitive categories. I think it's less competitive than it actually is. And then on the channel strategy piece, like something I'm obsessed with is optionality. Like I never want to be pigeonholed in a go-to-market context. And so what I was really, really interested in is how can I create something, some asset that I can sell, and feasibly I could sell it anywhere. Online, food service, grocery, big box, Walmart, but also Whole Foods, international. Like what is that thing? And in order for that to be the case, it has to be shelf stable, a favorable weight to price point ratio, long shelf life, minimum 12 months.
You're literally describing the opposite of my product. And I just actually want to call this out because people who listen to me on a regular basis, like we are going into another category. And these were all of the things we're like, okay, we've established our brand and we've made this like really nice community around this thing that aside from the lightweightness doesn't, you know, it's got a short shelf life. It has no home in the store. You know, no one knows what to do with it. You can't sell it online. It will not work, you know, in mass, all of that stuff. It's very funny that you're saying it, but everyone, like we're getting there. And the next one's going to have all this stuff. So anyway, it's just, it made me laugh.
Totally. As you were talking about. And I don't think it's all, I'm not so absolutist about all this stuff. Like I think actually quote unquote downsides are a moat in and of themselves because other people can't do it. So for example, it's really hard and that sucks because it's hard, but it's also good because other people can't do hard things.
Right. For sure.
And maybe you can. So, but yeah, so that's kind of how we thought about it. But online was the easiest mostly because you can scale from zero to one online just way faster than anywhere else. That just is the case. So, you know, we did a Kickstarter, sold between Kickstarter and Indiegogo, $90,000 worth of product. That was fake, like phantom product, didn't exist. But we sold 90K right out the gate. And we're like, whoa, okay. And I at that point was like, not like waffling on whether to go full time on it. Cause I had a job, but I quit my job. And then on the back, okay, so here's where the fundraising piece is interesting, which I think is not talked about enough. I have friends who started tech companies and they raised $3 million on a $10 million pre-money valuation with a PowerPoint deck. And it was right at the same time I was trying to raise money. And I was like, it's like laughable how different that is relative to CPG. And this was, of course, a different time also.
The
we were
years.
In the heat of the go-go years, which was candidly great in retrospect. But so I was like, all right. We're worth $4 million if we can do XYZ in the Kickstarter, which is, of course, is largely arbitrary. But like that first valuation is basically made up, but not totally made up. Like there is just a going rate for a company that, let's say, has generated some early sales and has a good founder, whatever. So I was like, all right, that's the number. And then once you pick it, you stick to it. And then we raised 600-something K on the back half of the Kickstarter. And that was really, really critical because I had been for years, even before the Kickstarter, working on this alone at nights and on weekends. I couldn't convince anyone to do it with me because it was not that sexy of an idea. Mm-hmm. But I was like, all right, I can hire a couple people now and we can start sprinting. And e-commerce was the way to start sprinting.
Yeah.
Because we could, you know, we parlayed the Kickstarter into a website. We parlayed that into an Amazon presence and then just started seeing what happened. And at that time, Amazon and of course a big tailwind at that point was keto. So we just sort of coincidentally, we created a low sugar, low carb, low net carb product for the brain purposes, right? Because having a bunch of carbs, you know, and spiking insulin and all that makes your brain work less good or less well. you know, and yeah, you have that 2 p.m. crash. And that was why I was interested in low carb and keto. Well, it just so happened the rest of the country got obsessed with it for weight loss purposes and other purposes. And so we just like found ourselves at the intersection of this massive macro trend and just started like ripping on Amazon. And we were only one of maybe 3-4 products, like I said, in that subcategory of bars on Amazon doing that. And it just, you know, it was like 20K a month and 40K a month and 80K a month. And that was how we scaled up really, really quickly.
That's amazing. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we're going to talk all about innovation and fun things like that.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
I'm back with Will Nitza, founder and CEO of IQ Bar. Okay, so before the break, we were talking about sort of riding the wave of keto. Jared and Peter are investors in my company from RX Bar. Their story obviously is, you know, amazing. I've had, the Magic Spoon guys on here. Like, there's definitely something to be said for building a good enough product at the right time of a dietary wave and just, as you said, like letting it rip. They have all sort of said like, there was just this, you know, this massive trend of people, and it almost didn't have to even be good at the beginning, right? Because the keto people notoriously don't even care that much about taste, and they are notoriously sticky, and they're notoriously like purple cows. Like, they spread the wealth. They talk about their diet a lot and they share their products a lot. Are you surprised at how long the keto thing lasted? Is it still going on? I mean, I was around when like the Scarsdale diet was, you know, I was around when there was like you should only eat carbs. And then it switched to you should never eat carbs in the 80s. And then it was like, you gotta, you know, there were diets where like you skipped protein altogether. I mean, it's really been back and forth and back and forth, protein, carb for, you know, the last 30, 40 years. So were you aware of it at the time? Did you tailor it at the time? You obviously started with the keto thing, like you said, because of carbs and brain, but clearly there was something else that people were looking for. You know, what's happening to keto now, I guess, is one of my questions.
Yeah, I think it was like it was supposed to be a 2 or 3 year trend that was a 7 year trend. And so, yes, it surprised to the upside of
is it over?
Plus X. No, it isn't. I think I would be lying if I told you I had a crystal ball and I could tell you exactly how it'll morph. But like I think where it is now and where it'll continue to be is a large niche of people. People will cycle on and off. Like it just mm-hmm. is a wildly effective way to lose weight, right? So at the physiological level, like biology isn't changing. So it's never like it's going to be big because it's effective. Any effective thing will never fully die. I think like the general consensus is it's very rigid, it's very militaristic. Most people aren't good at keeping a super rigid diet like that, that's so restrictive. I don't see it like truly getting back into like the mass market, but I think there'll be a very large niche. I mean, still you can look at the data while keto search terms have declined slightly, there's still a lot of people looking for keto stuff.
And certainly looking to, you know, I mean, the first thing you do when you feel a little bit like ughy is you cut out carbs.
Yeah. And I think it's just a reframing, honestly. Like if you talk to any brand that rode the keto wave, like it's not like this. Well, I think in some cases it is existentially a problem because they were keto whatever, like the mm-hmm. diet was in their name.
Yep.
So that's a problem. But for the most part, it's pivoting and reframing to low sugar and like low sugar, low net carb, and maybe not even the latter part. Like low sugar is mm-hmm. is just an evergreen strategy for, again, physiological reasons.
Yeah. Another thing that I've read that you said was, you know, and I mentioned it earlier in the show is, and I thought this was a really interesting insight that like people reach for bars for a goal. And when I read it, I started thinking about myself. Like I have my airport bar, I have my midday bar, you know, I have different bars for different needs, you know, and it's an interesting insight. You know, you either want just to like a fun snack where you don't feel, you know, or you're going someplace or it's a specific dietary thing. You know, my son just took, you know, his law exams and, you know, he's sitting there for 4 hours. It's, you know, and he unwrapped his bars so it wouldn't like make noise type of thing. But I'm wondering, as you're thinking about innovation, you're good at the social listening, you're out there hearing and looking around and seeing, but there are all these different groups of people and they all have different goals and they're reaching for bars for different reasons. So what was the process that you used to sort of lean into which group of people you wanted to please more? You know, I'm sure you were somewhat scientific about it, knowing you, the little that I do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first idea was brain food. That was like the original concept. And, it was like a hypothesis that I didn't know the answer to, which is do people want brain food? They obviously want a healthy brain. Otherwise they wouldn't take fish oil mm-hmm. and Prevagen and all these supplements. They obviously care about thinking well and not getting Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and neurodegenerative disease and all that. But very quickly to your point, it gets into a form factor discussion. So oftentimes mm-hmm. people make the mistake of conflating a desire someone has with the wrong form factor. Mm. So, mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. Caffeine. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, people want to drink caffeine, not eat mm-hmm. caffeine. Generally speaking. Are there a couple exceptions? Yeah, but not really. The exceptions are so few that they're, it's almost like de minimis. So that's kind of interesting, right? They have this desire to stimulate themselves, their brain and their heart rate and all that, but they don't have a desire to do it in a ready-to-eat food context. Mm-hmm. And so, like, that was the original hypothesis of, like, okay, do people want brain health via, like, a ready-to-eat food? And the answer is they kind of do, but it's actually incredibly nuanced. What we learned about bars is what you just said, which is people eat bars for very specific functional reasons, and it's always protein and sugar is always like one and, well, there's taste, which is sort of jockeys for one and two, depending on the crowd, right? You made a good point of like the keto crowd. Sometimes it's not one. Often it's not one if people are really diet forward, but often it is, right? So like taste, protein, sugar are always going to jockey for one, two, three. And then everything else is a distant second. But then there's so many like subcomponents. And basically what we learned about bar people is they're very diet specific, they're very goal specific, and they're label readers. Mm-hmm. There are other categories where people are not label readers. Like when you buy chips, you're not really a label reader.
Barbecue sauce, and not a label
and
reader.
And even the same person might not be a label reader on barbecue sauce, but they are on bars. So that's how crazy it is.
Yeah.
And so we just kept, so like I said, I'm obsessed with optionality. So I wanted to be able to, if I could, thread the needle across clean label, keto, the brain element, high plant protein, vegan profile overall. I wanted to see if I could thread that needle because it would allow us to pitch ourselves in different ways to different people, which certain people would say is a bad strategy. Actually, I chatted with Peter Rahal about this, and he's like, it's too much. Mm-hmm. And I don't even necessarily disagree with him because he has this incredible proof point of simplicity. Like, and that just wins. Like, ride that horse as hard as you can. And that's a way to win. But where I would disagree
it's
is
a way to win.
I actually think the like omni-valuable path is also a way to win.
Yeah. No, I mean, first of all, I like all the, when we talk to people who've had, and you know, again, like they've clearly done something incredible, and but they've done it in one way. If you talk to Daniel from Kind Bar, he would have a very different, right? He would say the minute that we made our bars chocolate, they had chocolate, the whole Kind Bar world changed, right? Or, you know, and on that note, I remember, like when we were in the Chobani incubator, the Bonza folks came. So this was 2018. So they were very early into their trajectory too, you know, and they had just the same product, and they had a way of pitching it to the people that, you know, wanted gluten-free pasta, and then other people who wanted heartier pasta or whatever the other thing was. And I remember just watching, like, on the screen, they were talking about just, you know, if you do have the ability. I mean, I think our product is very similar. We happen to be keto and we happen to be vegan, but we didn't make the sauce for the keto community or people who were vegan. And we have had a hard time sort of settling in on messaging, because sometimes when it is too many things, no one knows what the hell it is. But I think in your case, if there are three things that pretty much the bulk of bar people are looking for, and you're able to be all three and just like put a little bit of the thumb on the scale, depending on how you're, you know, who you're talking to, where you're talking to them, you know, that I don't think you're taking away from your simplicity, but have you found it to be challenging?
Well, so I think that what often people struggle with too is they say, well, okay, if you're going to focus on sugar, protein and things like that, well, then you're not different. Then you are going to get lost. And, and what I would say is, and again, this is kind of form factor specific to bars. Actually, that's not true. You just, those are like, table stakes, right? So someone has to check before you can even start the discussion of like what makes you different. So it's total table stakes. And so what we found is like the brain element is like a nice rounding element. It's a door closer, not a door opener. So they check protein. What's the protein source? Okay, plant. Okay, cool. Check. What is the carb count? What's the sugar count? Check. Okay, cool. Now tell me like why you're different. But if you don't check all those five boxes, you're never even going to have the option to pitch it. And some people don't even care beyond the first four. They're like, I don't care about the brand thing. Like, give me a box. And that's cool too. It kind of reminds me of the Allbirds thing. It's an eco-friendly shoe, but 90% don't care. They're just like, oh, it's a comfortable shoe. You have to win on the shoe being a good shoe and comfortable. And then, some subset will get really into the eco-friendliness and whatnot. And the last thing I would say is oftentimes people don't fully appreciate that the confluence of multiple things that are in and of themselves generic makes a product special. So if you can be keto but also paleo friendly and also vegan and also high protein, each one of those things in a silo is fairly generic, but when you can thread the needle, now the confluence of all of them makes it special.
No, I like that. And I like the door opener traits versus the door closer traits. And I think sometimes, you know, we get high on our own supply a little bit and we forget which is which. And it's a good thing to keep in mind. And you know, speaking of that, I think I remember in the Chobani incubator, the head of innovation sat down with us and he was like, so you know what my job is, right? And we're like, like you're the head of innovation at Chobani. And he's like, right. And I'm here to tell you to stop innovating. And I was like, what? You know, he was like, you've already over innovated. Like no one knows what chimichurri is. No one knows what, you know, romesco is. What the hell is tahini? You know, you live in a bubble. Like time to make something that just like people know what it is and they know what to do with it. And that is what we actually tried to make a barbecue sauce and it was really freaking good. And it was keto and vegan and it had no added sugar. It was just like dates. It was super delicious. But we learned very quickly that the barbecue, the people, that sort of Venn diagram of people who really love barbecue sauce, but people who don't want to eat a lot of sugar was not very high, or it wasn't enough it did not become a gateway SKU to the rest of the line. And it also felt a little bit somehow off with the rest of the line. And so, you know, again, I read something that you had said, you know, and when you're making a bar, for all the people out there listening who are going to make a bar, people want blueberry, chocolate, peanut butter. You don't have to go hard into sriracha, you know, yuzu, cacao, coffee. Like try to stick pretty much, you know, it's like the Chobani blueberry yogurt. It's 80% of their sales or whatever it is. So when you were talking about innovation though, you know, instead of necessarily innovating on flavors, you came up with another product. I want to hear a little bit about that. And I also want to hear if people basically like blueberry, chocolate, and peanut butter with a couple of others, where do you innovate?
Yeah. Well, so yeah, this gets into the whole platform versus single form factor, which again, I'll go back to RX Bar because it's an easy example of like they rode that to $100+ million selling bars and that's awesome. They caught lightning in a bottle though. And I at one point sat down and I went through that. There's that dichotomy of, okay, do you just try and become the biggest bar company possible? Mm-hmm. Or do you try and become a platform? And what's on a risk adjusted basis, like your best odds of getting to that, whatever the figure is, let's say 100 million. And basically what I determined is on a risk adjusted basis, you're more likely to get there via the platform approach. Mm-hmm. And then there's also all these other halo effects, like the ability to upsell different form factors that are non-cannibalizing. Mm-hmm. And so we did something that was very different from other bar companies in terms of moving into new categories. We moved into hydration.
Right.
Basically, we're interested in... didn't make a ball. We didn't make bites. We didn't make whatever. Mm-hmm. Peanut butter cups. So why did we do that? Well, for one, it checked off all the same checklist. Mm-hmm. Favorable price point to weight ratio, 2-year shelf life, blah, 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 blah. High gross margin. And then big category, like not as big, but hydration is huge. And then liquid IV really paved the way for that form mm-hmm. factor. And then we're about to do the same thing with coffee, instant coffee. Big, mm-hmm. big category. Same deal. Shipping powder, light. It's called IQ Joe. Yeah.
And I was going to say, like, this is where, our platform isn't like, we're not like in the fresh sauce business. We're in the, we help home cooks business. We're in the meal kit without the meal kit business. So in your case, coffee is brain food, right? I think that if it, innovation to me is one of the most fun things to discuss because you have all of these puzzle pieces, right? Like you said, there's the ops piece and the supply chain piece, and then there's the brand pillar piece. And does it make sense for us? And do we have right to be there from our, from our consumer? Are they looking to us for this type of thing? Do they trust the brand in that category? There's synergies with our buyers, let's say, or, there's so many things, and you put them into this like big machine, and then it spits out like coffee, hydration. I see it very clearly, for you guys.
So do I. I look at it as like, what are the occasions throughout a day? And what I'm trying to work backwards from is how do you check off all those boxes and hit in a non-cannibalizing way, like let's say 3 occasions throughout the day. Mm-hmm. And then also they have to be relevant to like the point of your brand, which for us is like brain and body functionality. So right. Satiation is 1, like check bars. Hydration is 2, caffeination is 3. All 3 mm-hmm. things highly relevant to brain and body performance. Everything has to be dietarily totally coherent. They all have to be clean label, ultra low sugar, yada, yada, plant-based. And so ostensibly they're very different, but actually they're very aligned in terms of, they're just hitting different occasions.
Yep. And y'all do sleep at some point too.
I didn't do it. This guy, Tommy, who worked at Circle Up, a VC that invested in us. Mm-hmm. I hit him up. He was an analyst there. And I was like, Tommy, I want to either do a sleep gummy or an instant mm-hmm. coffee. I need you to like crunch the numbers on which one I should do. And he put together this like incredible analysis to his credit. And it's super interesting. It was like, who are all the players? Mm-hmm. How is the category trending online? Blah, blah, blah. And basically it spit out like you should do coffee. And here's why. Sleep is a really, so what am I, I'm obsessed with more and more high consumption cycle products that are super sticky. What is sticky? Drugs are sticky. So caffeine is sticky. Mm-hmm. Sleep is sticky mm-hmm. because it's highly habitual and you have like a melatonin CBD gummy or whatever that you take. If you take that, you're just going to take that every night forever, mm-hmm. especially if it works. Yep. Super sticky. Right. So bars actually are somewhat sticky, but every incremental category we move into is highly sticky. Mm-hmm. So that's like another box to check.
Yeah. No, I think I want to go to the platforming thing because when I sent you my little pregame, some thoughts email, you brought up the platforming thing. And, I think about this all the time. And I think about, you know, sort of the Goldilocks. You know, there's like the baby bear, the mama bear, the papa bear, the mama bear, sort of the just right. And, you know, I mean, I think for those of us who are exposed to a lot of other companies, a lot of other founders, we like to read up on this stuff. It's really interesting what was successful and trying to sort of, you know, tease out what are the things that they all had in common. And it's funny because I was about to use, you know, so I think I mentioned Miguel Leal on every podcast. He's, you know, he was the CMO at Kind and then the CMO at Cholula and a good friend of mine. And we were talking and he said, you know, Cholula, you know, for years tried to platform, but essentially consumers really just wanted hot sauce from Cholula. I just saw like they McCormick just launched a line of Cholula salsas. So we'll see. But there's, you know, there's something very clean, very tidy, again, when it's high margin and it's super scalable and it's just sort of this like one product. It happens a lot in sauce, you know, or, you know, chips type of thing. Like popcorn is a good one. You know, it's just like down the line and it gets there quickly to your point. And it's just, you know, really strong on the EBITDA and it just gets acquired. I'm not building that. I don't know that I would know how necessarily. And I also don't think I would have that much fun doing that. The other side I think of is like these, you know, these companies that just launch a new product every other day and they're in so many categories and so many temperature states. And it almost feels like it's too soon every time they innovate because there's inevitably some time that's needed to educate consumers. And I don't see the efficiencies across those categories, so I'm confused what they're doing.
I also have no friggin' clue how they do that.
I agree. No, I have a few that I'm going to have on the show and I'm going to just, you know, because there are a couple brands that are in literally almost every set of the grocery store. And they're not even necessarily huge brands, but they're just kind of everywhere. And I'm kind of confused by it. I'm not sure, you know, if strategics I've been told don't be, even just being in two different temperature states is challenging for strategics, you know, from an acquisition perspective. Not that that's everything, but it is something that goes into that popper of, right, that plan. So, you know, the mama bear, you know, that what is that sort of like right down the middle where you're a platform where it protects you from cannibalization on products because there is that risk, where it protects the brand, where you are welcomed into people's lives, to your point, in, you know, different day parts and different occasions. That's tricky, but that's the fun part for me. And when to do it. You know, we waited a long time, I think. I don't know, maybe not that long, but you know, we're launching our second product line. It'll be 4 years after we launched our first.
Yeah, it's not all that dissimilar from us.
Yeah, and, you know, because it takes a while to get it right. I wanted to get the team right. I wanted to get, you know, all of our glitches worked out. I wanted to build a real brand so that there was pull for this new product line. And I can go to my retailers and say, there are, you know, we have 250,000 Pinterest followers. And the number one thing we hear is, I can't find the product and I don't live near a Whole Foods. You know, like, let's give them something to buy, you know? And I guess I'm assuming your thoughts are somewhat similar on there, but I'd like to hear them.
Yeah, I actually don't think there is a Goldilocks zone. Mm-hmm. I think it's a spectrum of risk. It's like drinking alcohol. A drop of alcohol is bad for you, and many drops is really bad for you, but it's like all a spectrum of risk. And so I think you can win by having a zillion SKUs. People have won that way. Like, On It was like a big supplement brand, but they had a zillion SKUs, and then they got acquired by Unilever. Mm-hmm. So I would never want to do that. That sounds crazy. I don't know how they did that operationally. You're marketing so many different things with so many different value props. I don't want to do it, but you can win that way. I would argue that's a lower probability way to win, but it can be done. It is a way to win.
Just challenging that for 1 second. But like, do you think that's specifically, I mean, supplements is different from food, right? Like there's probably one place that's making all of those 85 different pills where, you know, instead of building all new supply chains. So,
well, let's even say I do see it a lot more. I don't know. There's brands like a Perfect Keto, right? Like they have a ton of SKUs and it's more of a marketplace. And that is one approach. So it can be done and it can be done right. Well, I think. And then of course the opposite is the RX bar thing or the Cholula thing, which is, that is the cleanest. I agree. It's the least fun, but it's probably, I was going to say it's probably the like quote unquote best strategy if you want to get acquired, but it's only the best strategy if you think you can genuinely scale fast. And that's a huge caveat and a huge asterisk. So it's like the it's risky, but so what thing? Like if you, in theory, having scaling one form factor is like better. But the flip side is what if you could grow faster by having a couple? So now it's like you have to do your SWOT analysis on, okay, well, this is good and bad for these reasons. And this is good and bad for these reasons. So for me, personally, for our specific context, I want to play in three categories. I don't want to play in four categories. I don't want to play in two categories. Definitely don't want to play in one category. Three categories is like the Goldilocks for me because I think we and our model is let's grow the like hero line, which will be bars. So similar to kind of the Quest bar model. You're going to, Quest has chips and peanut butter cups and blah, 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 blah. But like, 85% of the business is their bars. Yep. And so it's just kind of cool and novel and ways to upsell and yada, yada, but you still have your hero, the mothership. And that's the model I like personally. So, because I think it hedges a little bit against acquirers not being too pumped that you're in multiple categories. Cause you can say, look, like, yes, we are, but the mothership is this category. Right. And your risk is highly mitigated in category B and C because they're just a, 5-7% of the business each.
Yeah. And if they're profitable, right, they're nice little marketing tools for the mothership.
Yeah. And like you may decide in a couple of years because not every brand is platformable. So that's like a binary thing. Like is platformable, isn't like, yes or no? Like Cholula, it sounds like wasn't really platformable. Still a massive brand, had a massive exit. But like, I'm just saying like to prove that you are even platformable in the first place, that doesn't have no value. Like that's useful even just to know because you can say, hey, we still have the mothership, but we've shown here that if you want to platformize, blow out the platform, you can.
Yep. All right. I had a couple of other questions, but I don't want to stress Liam out because sometimes I go over. So I'm going to say one last thing. You had one of your shower thoughts about pilots and that they should get on the frickin' loudspeaker when turbulence happens and just say, hey, we're going to have a couple minutes of turbulence, or even better, like before the turbulence start, just be like, hey, it's going to get bumpy for a few minutes. I don't know why they do that. And I just wanted to say, I agree with you. And it would make me less stressed out if they did that. So I don't think that there are any pilots listening, but if you know a pilot and you're listening, please tell them. So
I'm sitting in the Delta Sky Miles lounge, which I'm not a member of. I had to purchase a credit card. I just sign up for a credit card to then buy a day pass so that I could get in a quiet pod so that I could record this.
Well, so I appreciate that you did that. Thank you. And just generally, thanks for coming on the show. It was really fun getting to talk to you after reading you for this long. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me.
And Liam, thank you for engineering the show, as always. And couldn't do it without you. Listeners, I have, like I said at the beginning, next week is episode 200, which is kind of crazy. It's like 200,000 downloads, and we're up to like 2,500 downloads a week or something like that. I don't know if that's good or what. I don't care. I'm just happy that you're listening, and I'm happy that it's helpful. And we have a little special guest. He's, you know, he's been in this game for a while, and he's got a lot of really important lessons for all of us to learn from. So I thank everyone for listening, and I'll be back next week with my 200th episode of In the Sauce. In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.